Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. Meet the characters involved, hear their stories and find some insight to help us all get faster on our bikes. This week is a special episode where we're going to be joined by two of the top engineers in the business, Jason Chamberlain from Specialized and Torkel Sinton from Ohlins. They're going to be joining us to talk about data acquisition, past, present and future, and give us a little bit of insight into just how Loic Bruni gets his bike working so damn well. Before we get stuck into that, just a couple of quick things. First up, massive thanks to 661 for supporting this episode and helping us to keep bringing you great content for free. 661 have got a great range of helmets and protection, and as a Downtime listener, they're offering you 25% off, which is super generous. All you need to do is to head to 661.com, that's S-I-X-S-I-X-O-N-E.com, and use the code DOWNTIMEPODCAST25 at the checkout. It's Downtime Podcast as all one word, all lowercase, followed by the number 25. I've been testing out some of 661's latest products, and there are a couple that stand out for me so far. First is the Reset helmet. It's a really great looking full face helmet that retails for just €99. I talked about it a bit in last week's episode, but it's nearly the same weight as my old Carbon 661 full face, which cost a lot more. So they've done a real good job on that one. It's definitely worth checking out if you want a full face for the occasional uplift day or big mountains trip. They've also got a MIPS version coming in January, which is going to retail for just €160. And even better, your Downtime listener discount code will still work on that too. I've also been really impressed with their Recon knee pad. It's a lightweight pad and it's obviously not going to offer as much in a crash as some of the stiffer, heavier pads out there. But it's super comfortable to the point that you'll barely know it's there. Fits great and the pads seem to stay in place really well without feeling tight or restrictive. And it uses this Poron XD foam that will harden up on impact, so it still offers a good amount of protection despite being super comfy and lightweight. Well worth for checking it out. Head over to 661.com and have a look if you're in the market for some new kind of all-day knee pads. While you're online, don't forget to head to downtimepodcast.com for all your podcast needs. There's the show notes for all the episodes with links to the things that we've mentioned in the show. There's a whole page there to help you subscribe to the podcast so that you get each episode delivered to your device for free as soon as it's available. You can join our mailing list there to keep up to date with everything podcast related. And there's a link to our web store where we've now got hoodies, sweatshirts, t-shirts and mugs available. The merch is top quality. It's taken me a while to get it where I want it, but I'm super happy with it now. And the proceeds go towards improving the podcast and bringing you more in-depth content. If you bought something already, then thanks so much. It's awesome seeing the photos of you wearing it, so keep them coming in. And if you've got some merch coming your way for Christmas, then I hope you like it. Right, time for this week's guests. We've got Jason Chamberlain from Specialized and Torkel Sinton from Ohlins. We're going to be chatting about the past, present and future of data acquisition, getting some insight into how Loic works with Ohlins and Specialized to get his bike set up so well. And we've also got some setup tips from these top guys. So without further ado, here's Jason and Torkel. Okay, this week we've got two guests joining us from Specialized. We've got Jason Chamberlain. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hi there, thank you.
And from Ohlins, we've got Torkel Sinton. Torkel, welcome on board.
Thank you.
All right, before we get stuck into the topic of data acquisition for mountain biking, which is what we're here to chat about today, let's find out a little bit about each of you and get some background. So Jason, if we start with you, if that's okay, tell us a little bit about your career so far at Specialized and what you're doing at the moment.
Sure. I've worked at Specialized for about 22 years, and my first job out of college was working at an O-ring company, and that got boring really fast, and I had the opportunity to work in the test lab at Specialized. So I immediately jumped ship, and I've been here for 22 years. I worked on the very first demo platform and designed all the demos since the beginning. And I've been on the teams that work on Enduro and Stump Jumper FSR frame design. So pretty heavily focused on a full suspension frame design for the time I've been here.
Okay. And what's your current job title there?
We're not real big on titles here. I just say design engineer.
Okay. Cool. So you're working with big teams of designers looking at kind of future technology and the suspension platforms. Is that kind of a fair summary?
Yes. Every year I'll have every I should say every model cycle, I'll be assigned a, a project to be the lead engineer on, and then I will help the other teams as a support engineer to steer the direction of all the full suspension designs. So I'm involved in one way or another with all the full suspension frames that we're putting out every year.
Awesome. Good stuff. Awesome job. All right, Torkel, tell us a little bit about your side of things and what you've been up to at Olin's.
Yeah, I entered the Olin's crew 91, which is a long time ago. And I came directly from the university and master degree in design engineer. So my first job was to work with the design work with motocross, especially GPs, and also road bike suspension. So I got more and more heavily involved in the racing side and been developing engineer for racing side, mostly off-road stuff, but also a lot of road racing. A lot of road racing and things like that.
Yeah, cool. And when did the mountain bike side of things start to happen with Olin's? It's fairly recent, I think.
Yeah, it's fairly new for us. We entered the mountain bike scene in 2013 and basically be going from there. And I were directly involved in the mountain bike development, and it became big pretty fast for us, so we had to recruit a lot of new members, so we created a new team. And today I'm only working with mountain bikes since a couple of years.
Awesome. All right, good stuff. The perfect people then to talk about bike design and data acquisition. Good stuff. So before we get into that, there's a few terms that get banded around or kind of used interchangeably, and I'm not totally convinced they are. So people talk about data acquisition and they also talk about telemetry, which maybe not quite the same thing. Torkel, maybe you could just kind of explain those two terms briefly.
I would say so. But the telemetry is the complete system for the measuring on the bike. And so the data acquisition is the real data when you are what you are measuring.
Okay, cool. So I guess, you know, there's a number of different reasons for taking data from a bike or from some suspension. And a lot of us will probably be familiar with it from seeing it on some of the athletes' bikes at the Downhill World Cup. But Jason, can you take us through kind of from your perspective, some of the different reasons why you would go and log data on a bike?
Well, there's a couple different reasons. As a frame design engineer, you want to make sure you understand the loads. So you might be measuring the strain or the forces going into the frame so that you can design the strength properly without overbuilding the frame. You also are concerned with the performance of the frame. So someone who works purely on the shocks and shock tuning and suspension is going to want to understand the shaft speeds, the way the shock is moving, how much travel you're using or not using. And so when you see a race team collecting data at the race, they're trying to fine tune their suspension for that particular track and the conditions they encounter when they get there. If you see an engineer out on the trail, he might be collecting suspension data, or he might be looking at loads on the frames.
Okay. So you use it not only for performance and speed, I guess, but also for helping you design the bike and optimize it from a kind of strength to weight perspective. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, it's for sure you need to understand the loads. And when I started at Specialized in the 90s, mountain bike strength standards were barely even in existence. They were in development. And I worked in the test lab and I helped the industry design a lot of the test standards we have today. Because if you remember the 90s, we had all kinds of things breaking. Bottom bracket spindles would break, wheels would collapse, forks would snap off. If you look at free ride footage from way back, you see all kinds of frame failures, which you rarely see anymore because we finally have a good enough understanding of the loads that bikes are undergoing that we can design to that. And that's how bikes have gotten so light today, is because we have a very careful understanding of the loads and can design the right safety factor into them. So in the early days, everybody was collecting data, and at some of the, we had a bunch of meetings, whether it was an ISO meeting or an ASTM meeting, where test engineers from different companies would get together and we'd actually share data and collaborate and try to come up with industry-wide tests that would benefit the industry and help make a safer bike for the consumer. And those standards were mostly trail-based. So the next level was downhill-based. So we're making free ride and downhill bikes in the 90s with hardly any under any standardized testing worldwide on how to test them. So to be responsible, you had to know the loads going into those frames so you could design properly, especially when guys were hucking bigger and bigger and bigger and the speeds were faster and faster. You really had to understand those loads to design the frame right.
Yeah, yeah. So do you, would it be fair to say that you don't log as much these days now that you have a better understanding for the loads, or is it still something that's always progressing?
It's always progressing, but we certainly have plateaued in that we have a pretty good understanding within Specialize of the loads that a frame is going to see under any given circumstance. But with new designs, we like to, you know, gut check and benchmark. Are we still in the right place? Have things evolved? Are guys going faster? Are amateurs going faster? There was one real interesting test we did in Whistler about 10 years ago, where we sent a pro rider and an amateur rider down the same trails on the same bikes. And we wanted to find out who put the most loads on the bike, because pros are very smooth and amateurs are pretty chunky, and the results were pretty interesting.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to ask about that a bit later on, actually, the difference in the data you might get from a pro rider compared to someone more average like myself. Yeah, go on, tell us a bit more about that. What kind of things did you see?
Sure. So this shouldn't come as a surprise, but the pros, they go huge. When they're hitting jumps down A-line, they are going huge. They bottom out in the face of the jumps. They overshoot. They bottom out in the landings. The pros, for sure, put their bikes through much harsher conditions than amateurs do. So right. When it comes to strength, we design for, you know, the toughest pro out there. And when it comes to suspension performance, the top pros, they hit things so much faster than even the best amateur, you know. You know, the top 10% of guys are really hauling down the trail, and they hit stuff so fast and so hard that they really are in a different world of performance and tuning for the top tier athletes.
Yeah. Yeah. So was there anything surprising in the data from the amateurs then, or was it always kind of lower level than the pro riders?
It turned out that it was always lower level. Yeah. They just don't quite get the speed and the magnitude, and therefore they don't generate the force, even though they might be hitting stuff much less smoothly. They don't have the same inertia and magnitude of events that the pros do. So the loads for amateurs were definitely lower in this particular case.
Yeah. So, racing is a good way to prove out a bike's strength. And if it can survive under a pro rider, then it's probably going to survive under a normal rider.
That would be a fair statement, yeah.
Yeah, cool. All right, Torkel, over to you. Let's talk a little bit about the suspension side of things. What kind of stuff do you measure when you go data logging, looking purely at the suspension side?
Well, I think we are measuring more or less the same thing as for the frame side, maybe adding another layer. But for the suspension side, we also have all the problems with the strength and the load to the end die shafts and so on. We have the heat, and we have everything around to basically make the product physically work properly. But we also have need to collect all the data for the movements. How fast are they? How fast are the accelerations? What are the frequencies? And try to combine that to what we are actually planning to damp. And so with a position measure on the suspension, we will find out with a balance on the bike, and if it's a good balance, and if it's kept in a good position, or if it's transferring weight too fast or too slow for a given situation. But so basically everything around what the suspension does is important to us. But we also have another layer that we need to use, and that is the dynamic side of things. So not only adding what we do, where is it positioned, what is the rod speed, but also measuring pressures inside. Basically, all shock absorbers and all dampers have some kind of fluid as a damper, which means that we have a pressure on a surface. So basically measuring that, and then we will find out if we have deviation from the expected movements and if we have hysteresis and things like this. So basically working through that layer, we can work on the hydraulic side and the dynamic performances of the product.
Can you give a feel for the sort of amount of data channels that you might record during one test then? Because that sounds like a lot of parameters that you're recording.
I think it's really related to what we want to achieve when we are measuring. But normally we don't use more than 8 channels. Normally that is enough. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And are you, when you look at the data, you know, we've seen, I guess, on a few internet kind of articles, you'll get to see a photograph of a computer screen with a lot of very complicated data channels shown on it. And it's very easy to get blown away by that. But how are you interpreting the data? Are you looking at the raw data? Are you creating channels that are a summation or a calculation based on the raw data? How do you go about taking it? Because it's very easy to draw false conclusions, I think.
Yeah, I also think it's very easy to draw false conclusion. And I think also, like you, when you're seeing someone having a screen full of strange curves. But normally, if you measure something, there is something you're looking for. So basically trying to look at that in more precise way. If you are considering to improve a bike on a test track and so on, you're looking for the balance, you're looking for the positions of a bike, you're looking for maybe how much damping you're bringing out if you have sensors inside and so on. And then you optimize for that situation. And normally you have a GPS connected to it also, so you can run the same loop on and on again. But if we talk more about how to improve the products, either it's from strength position or higher frequencies, or if it is from dynamic perspective, there's other things we have to look for.
Okay. You mentioned in that the balance of the bike. Can you use that maybe as an example? How do you visualize how well the bike is balanced from the data? What things are you looking for?
Well, if we are looking at improving a bike on the field, it's about repeating the measurements and see what the differences has become. And normally you're looking for some kind of behavior that you want to improve, a landing situation, a G out or a corner or whatever it can be. So the balance of a bike, what would you see and what we normally overlay in one way or the other, that's the position of a rear suspension and front suspension. So both where it are in the stroking and also, of course, how it moves.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm trying to get my head around, and I had this conversation with a friend earlier today. Mountain biking by its own nature is semi-chaotic, and it's hard to do the same thing twice, ride the same piece of trail twice. And therefore, I guess it's not always easy to compare times to look at whether a change has been an improvement or not. How do you approach suspension tuning to try and work around that chaotic nature? How do you get to a point where you strongly believe that the changes that you're making are beneficial and helping the rider go faster?
Well, you're absolutely right that it is a chaotic situation, and the rider, even if he tries, will not be exactly at the same position each run. So when it comes to making the rider faster, it's more about actually giving them trust in the bike and feeling that they feel safe and secure, having the grip and being ready to try to go faster. So it's a lot if a rider is not confident in a corner or loses the grip each time and so on, then there is a position, then there is a place to start looking into that, what is actually happening, how is the balance, can we change it? And if we see in a specific condition that we are very light on the front end, which means that the fork is almost fully out or fully out, then it's easy to understand that the grip will be fairly low. So a rebalancing of a bike, if a grip in the front is a problem, could be the right thing, which means that the loose grip in the front could be that you need to raise the rear a little bit instead of actually start changing the front. So these kind of very basic things is how you can use the measurements to understand.
Okay, interesting stuff. So would it be fair to say that you understand what good data looks like? You know how you would like the bike and the shock to behave, and therefore the time maybe is less relevant. It's more about what you see in the data and tying that to the rider's comments and how they feel.
Well, I wish I could be that wizard in looking at the figures and fix the bike, but that hasn't happened. And I think there's a far way to go before we, at least in this chaotic world, where we can improve a bike only by looking at the figures. The central thing here is the rider still, and the central thing is that the rider is confident. So I can perhaps use and look at the computer how I can add some confidence to the rider, but it's still the rider that is going to do the improvement of a bike.
So it's still very much rider-led situation, yes. Then. Okay. And you guys, I guess over the years, have worked with a number of different riders. Do different riders have different styles and different way they approach this, different levels of comfort with the technical side of things?
Sure. It's a big difference between how a rider wants to approach and what we think is important for the bike and what we feel confident with. So I guess that each and every rider has their own fingerprint of how we want to do the setups. So basically, the acquisitions cannot really force people into one riding style. It needs to be adjusted to how a rider wants to go about it.
Yeah. And have you ever, any of you ever come across situations where you've got a feeling of how to make something technically quick, but maybe the rider doesn't like the way that feels? Is there ever kind of a disagreement between, I guess, engineering and rider feel?
No, that never happens. Yeah, so every the one question you asked was the quality of rider feedback, and Troy Brosnan, who I absolutely love, we met him when he was 15 at Whistler, and he was just such a ripper from such a young age, and he was always very casual, very calm, and was happy with whatever bike we gave him and helped him out with. And then as soon as he won a world championship, his confidence was through the roof, and he really became much more picky and sensitive to his setup. So when you talk about rider confidence, that's everything. I don't know that his sensitivities magically changed when he won, but his confidence went up much higher. So I thought that was a good indication that the rider confidence is the most important thing. And you have different levels of sensitivity for sure from the riders, and different riders absolutely want different things. Every time we get a new athlete, they've got a list of things that they believe that they want different on our bike from the beginning. So we always try to balance, you know, where are we today? What does a pro athlete want? And what is the consumer going to want? And try to find a balance that works for everyone.
Yeah, it must be tricky, right? So you've had a number of very different style riders on the bike over the years, with Sam Hill, Troy Brosnan, Aaron, and now Loic. Yeah, how do you create something that works for them but still works for the general public? How much of what we end up with is driven by the athletes, and how much is either changed or kind of tamed down for normal riders?
It's tricky because we like to sell what the pros ride. And we know that what the pros ride isn't appropriate for the majority of riders. But you also can't tell riders, hey, you're not as good as the pros, so we're going to give you something that's dumbed down. They want the same level of performance that the pros get. So we, as much as we try to sell the same product to both, we usually end up making some custom parts for the pro racers, because they're real particular about a certain point, whether it's chainstay length or something else. So the pros usually get custom no matter what, and we transfer down as much as we can learn from the pros to the consumers to offer them the best bike possible as well.
Who's been the most tech savvy of the riders that you've had? Who's been kind of most into the data side of things and like getting their hands dirty from an engineering side?
Well, it's probably the easy answer is probably Loic and his team. When they joined Specialized, they came with their own data acquisition system and a history of using that system. And we have done data with all of our team. But this is the first time that a rider came to us and said, hey, this is what we do. How does that correspond with what you do? And we took a good look at their data and what they're doing. And like I mentioned before, what Racing Jack, the mechanic, and Loic are doing on track day is a little different than what Torkel and I as engineers are doing outside the track. They're trying to fine-tune what they have specifically for that track for that day. So if the track is steeper, the balance between front and rear might be different. Or if the track is rougher, they might need a different setting so that they use the travel appropriately. And if the track is less rough, maybe they run it softer so they use more travel. So they're trying to, you know, really fine tune the track on the day that they show up to the race.
So is there talk or is there a lot of work with yourself kind of in the off season with Jack and Loic to help them understand how the suspension behaves and how each of those, well, basically what each of the knobs do and what effect they like to have with data, so that when they go into the season, they understand, okay, we need to change this. This is the way to go about it. And we're likely to need to move, you know, two clicks, three clicks. Is there a lot of off-season work there?
Well, if it's about two and three clicks, it wouldn't be that much work, I think. But if we speak about general about dynamics, and if we are having an issue that we think we can improve or are asked to improve, then normally we can use the acquisitions and the data to start working from there. So a typical scenario could be that the first step is basically taking that readout from the bike and record it into the dyno and basically see what the product does in the dyno and see how it works and correlates to what we were thinking to. If it's only about amount of damping or position sensitive damping, like when we are letting the bump rubber hit or when we are adding damping at the end of a stroke, if we have such a device, then it's pretty simple to add on. But normally, if there are larger questions, it's not about the amount of damping, it's about the dynamics. And normally, it's about the difference between rebound and compression. And it's easy to think that a bike, especially a downhill bike, it is easy to think that it's the kind of balance, so it's working from the 1G position all the time. But in reality, it's really not. It's never in the middle position. So basically, it's easy to separate in which segment we should improve and consider how the damping or the spring character should be changed at that position.
Okay, does the units, the suspension units that a team like Specialized have at the start of the season, does that get changed throughout the year? Are you taking feedback and data from the races and kind of continually evolving the product throughout the season?
If it's needed, yes, but I would say that it's not so often it's needed. I think is what we have learned through the years and from all these riders everywhere is that it's so important that you start the season with a confident team and a confident rider. And if you manage to do your pre-testing well, so entering to the first race confident, then the rest of the year will be pretty good. If you are, So if you're coming to a race and you're starting with a new team, a new rider, and you start the whole thing at the first race, it's pretty sure that they're going to be maybe not so confident and they will have issues and there will be a long loop until we enter to a comfort zone where everyone is satisfied with the setups of a bike.
Exactly. You don't really have time to refine the bike during the race season. So we do all that in the off season, and the bike that the rider shows up at the beginning of the season is a result of much testing in the off season. Yeah. And like exactly what Torkel said, you don't want to mess around too much during the season. The rider's got to start the season completely confident that his setup is right, that it's where he wants it. And then we just make fine tuning along the way to adapt to a particular track. But there aren't giant changes in the mid season generally, if possible.
Okay. Would suspension internals change from track to track, or is it not? You know, are there kind of the differences in the track not that significant that you can get to where you need to be on the adjustment that the fork has
normally,
naturally?
The setups remain the same, and it's only small modifications as a spring preload or a click here and there. And in the old days, if you're backing off 10 years, there was a lot of changes, different shocks for different tracks and so on. But these days are more or less over. If the tracks are more or less the same style, then the setups will be well suited regardless.
So how much do you think that the data acquisition has helped Loic throughout the last few years? I mean, the bike always looks like it's working incredibly well. I have to say, when you see it on Red Bull TV, it looks like it's sticking to the ground. Do you think it's been a significant part of his success over the last couple of seasons?
I think that the team that is working with acquisitions on a daily basis and doing a lot of comparison measurements, they know how to get fast in order with a bike to get a good baseline. So I think that the way they're acting with the acquisitions is helping them to have a stable performance.
For sure it helps Loic, because Loic looks at the data and his Jack and his team go over it with him and tell him, okay, this is where you are. We're going to change this. It's going to make you faster. It's going to do this. It's going to fix this here. And that has to boost your confidence, yeah. Right?
And also, if you're talking, I had problems in that corner, I couldn't get around fast enough and so on, then we can look at that particular corner and we can do a different runs on it and see the differences and find which way is fastest through. And then the problem is solved. So yeah. The tool, we're actually having the GPS also attached to it and see exactly what the bike does. And since you see what the bike does, you also see what the rider do, regardless of what he says. But you see what the bike is doing. So yeah. And there's a rider pushing the bike in that direction. So I think it's a very convenient tool for them to be fast in finding issues and solve them.
And how much of it do you think is actual physical improvements to the performance of the athlete in the bike? And how much of it do you think is kind of a mental benefit in that, well, the data said this and now we've changed it, so it must be quicker and I must be able to ride that corner harder? That do you have any kind of thoughts around that?
Well, is there really a difference?
Yeah, good question.
Someone once told me that perception is reality. So even if I believe it's physically slower, but the rider believes it's physically faster, which one is right?
Yeah, true.
Well,
what
I
do
think
you think,
it's
Torkel?
Pretty impossible to tell a rider and that now you are faster and then he is faster. So basically it needs to come together. If a rider feels more confident and thinks that, okay, now we actually solved this problem, now I feel good about it, then he will be faster.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking on Loic's bike they measure braking as well? Do they have like some kind of brake force transducer?
Yeah, they measure the braking. They like to kind of get a feel for how much they're on the brakes. And they prefer a little bit more braking feedback than other riders did. So they like to get a feel for how much they're on and off the brakes, because it gives you an idea if the suspension is being affected at all during the times you're on the brakes. So they measure that and kind of get a feel for when they're on and off the brakes.
And can they use that data effectively to try and help them brake less? Or because sometimes you feel like you're not braking and you are. Does it help unearth some of that
I'm
stuff?
Sure,
I think that's the goal for sure. Go ahead, Torkel.
I'm sure they are using that, because the thing, we're going through a corner and you will see exactly when you hit the brake in comparison to the GPS signal, and also see what the suspension does. it's a very easy and simple way to see if you can break later or less and feel confident still. It's a that's a very good part where you can use the measurement to actually go faster.
And they're, they're measuring the actual braking pressure, so they know how hard they're braking, not just if and when they're braking.
Okay. And do they have any way of knowing if the bike or the wheel is in contact with the ground?
Sure.
I'm not sure how you do that, but...
You can measure wheel rotation.
Go on.
You will see...
If you're on the brakes and you're in... Sorry. Go ahead, Torben.
If you're on the brakes and you're slipping on the ground, that's one thing. But from the data acquisition, depending on how you measure, you can for sure see if you have a wheel on the ground or not. That's very easy.
And that's based on rotational speed. And is it that simple? If you've got rotational speed and it's not changing significantly,
but this,
then you're
this
on the ground.
This chaos that you're riding in is... If you look at it, you have what the chassis is doing, and you have what the bumps and whatever obstacle on the track is doing, and then you have a frequency of each and every knob. So if the knob frequencies are gone, then you are not touching the ground. So it's very simple to see if you have contact to the ground and what type of contact to the ground you have.
Okay. So if the suspension data goes very quiet.
I wouldn't say quiet
anymore.
Because you can you can still be in a transfer in one way or the other. But for sure, you can see a lot of things.
When you're measuring the loads in the frame, if you have your strain gauges set up correctly, you can measure a difference from the left and to the right. And so on some of the experiments we do, we can tell when the loading is suddenly left, right, left, right, left, right. We know the rider's pedaling. And when he's in the air, you can see that there's no loads on the frame. So you can easily recreate a track and know where they're pedaling, where they're coasting, when they're in the air, and when they're on the ground.
Yeah, okay. Clever stuff. Interesting. And do any, as far as you guys know, are any of these teams at kind of World Cup level using strain gauge stuff to look at that particular, those kind of things? Or is it purely brake, wheel speed, GPS and suspension kind of position and movement?
Again, it depends, what you're looking for. In the off season, we do a lot of frame strain gauging. During the race season, we're just looking at suspension tuning. So it kind of depends, what your goals are at the moment, what you'll be recording.
And one thing that kind of puzzles me a little bit, I guess, is that it's only Loic on the team that I've ever seen using the data logging at a race. Is there a reason why we don't see Finn and Miranda using it?
I'm not sure why. Possibly just the amount of time and resources they have. Torkel, do you have any insight to
that? Not really. But when the race is on, there's no meaning to adjust anymore. So from that perspective, it wouldn't make sense. So I guess it's more about gathering data to get ready for the next race that is important then. But I don't have a good answer either. I'm not really sure.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I thought I'd ask because it does seem odd. But like you say, there is a lot of overhead with it, both from kit in having a separate bike ready to go with the equipment on it, but also in the data analysis because it's a lot. There's a lot to look at from even one run of a downhill track.
Yeah, even Loic and his team, they want to do as little data acquisition as possible. They want to get to practicing the track, memorizing the track, selecting their lines, and they don't want to be tuning the bike all week long. So they limit themselves to usually the first day and the first few runs with the data acquisition bike. Then they check out and they only ride the race bike for the rest of the week.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. So yeah, all that setup work's done pretty early on then.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. So data acquisition, it's progressing in the sport, definitely. And as the years go by and technology improves, the equipment that you need to record data is getting smaller and smaller and cheaper and cheaper. To the point where I think Saracen, I'm not sure if it's been launched or they're going to launch a bike with an option of the data logging equipment built into it at the downhill end of the spectrum anyway, for anyone to use and to look at. Where do you think it's all heading? Do you think we'll see more kind of inbuilt telemetry on bikes or data logging on bikes? Where do you think we'll end up with all this?
I think there's some danger to too much data. Even if you're an expert, you can get overloaded with data. So giving, just because you can collect the data, it's not difficult to collect data anymore. Back 20 years ago, you used to have a giant backpack and you could maybe record four channels and you had a laptop in the backpack. Now you have these tiny devices that are on board that will collect more data than you know what to do with. And look at power meters on cranks and hubs and pedals. Those are becoming very, very common. The sensors cost has come way down. So there's an interesting analogy, one that I make, where David Lynch, the famous movie director, was once asked in an interview if he was worried about cinema quality, high definition cameras coming down in cost so much that anyone could buy one. And would that be a threat to him and his craft if anyone could make a Hollywood quality movie? And his response was, pencils and papers have been around forever, but that doesn't make everyone a writer. So just because data is available doesn't mean you know what to do with it. So as a frame builder, if you're going to provide data to consumers, you need to provide a way for them to understand that and to make it easy for them to incorporate and adapt to their writing style. So the trick is not getting the data, it's what to do with it once you get it.
Yeah. And there's a few kind of people trying to do stuff with it. So Quark, ShockWiz, I haven't had the chance to use one yet, but I hear they're quite, you know, the interface itself is relatively simple and it gives you direction rather than just giving you a load of graphs that you don't know what to do with. Do you think we'll see more of companies trying to help us get our bikes set up better in that sort of way?
Absolutely. From our side, we introduced AutoSag on our air shocks a few years ago, and that's a simple push button on your shock that puts your pressure right in the right starting range. And, you know, most people would benefit just from having the fundamentals right. As long as you've got your sag and your spring rate or your air pressure correct, that's a great starting point. So many people don't even know where to start with that. So there are more and more tools to help people. There are tiny plastic gauges that measure your sag, up to super sophisticated apps for your phone. Specialized recently launched an app where you can look up the bike you have, the shock you have, and the fork you have, and it'll give you starting positions for all of your settings out of the box for that particular bike. So for sure, the ability to mess up your suspension is quite high, and it's on us to help help consumers understand what to do with all the setup options that we're giving them.
What about from your side, Torkel? What do you see as kind of the next step with the data side of things? We've already seen Fox Live Valve launch this year, which is kind of controlling suspension. It's still in a relatively simplistic way, but live while you're on the trail. Where do you think it will?
Well, it's hard to say. I think, like Jason said here, that a lot of the important stuff that is really important to get a good ride is within the initial setup and the balance and spring and so on. And for sure, that is an important side to have a good and safe ride. But in the future, it's hard to say where the measurements are going to be used. If we look at the automotive side, today there is more or less each and every expensive car has a fully automatic suspension, which means that we also have a complete measuring operation going on with the car. So depending on situation, what's going on the car, side loads or turning or whatever, the suspension will correlate to that. And I guess down the road, also for mountain bike, it will enter in the same direction.
What are the barriers to that at the moment? Is it kind of size and weight? Are they the main things to get all of this small enough to get it to work on a mountain bike?
I think one of the issues now is that, and that of course will remain for some time, is that any type of adjustment you're doing, regardless of how frequently you make the adjustment, you will need power to change things. So a battery pack would last for a while, but how long? And if you don't have a lot of capacity as of energy, then you can't do a lot of adjustment. And then you come to the next position. Is it really worth it? So I think that we will see a lot of trend changes coming, especially with e-bikes coming along. There is power available. So I guess that we can see different scenarios, different development for these type of bikes.
Yeah. I was thinking, as you were saying, e-bikes, obviously you've got that power there, and it's already a heavier unit, so maybe can handle a bit more weight thrown at it. Yeah, interesting times. So while we've got you guys, any top tips on suspension setup? Any kind of common mistakes that you see people making a lot?
I'll throw out a couple tips, and I'm sure Torkel has a couple as well. Always stick with the fundamentals. Make sure you have the right spring rate or the right air pressure, and check it periodically to make sure you're still on the right spring rate. That's the most fundamental thing, is make sure your ride height and your spring rate is appropriate. And then the other thing is, I took a class from Paul Thied, who's a very famous motorcycle suspension tuner, and he offers a class in suspension design in Southern California, which I took. And he said that your rebound knob is a one-way dial. That's what everybody thinks. No one ever turns their rebound knob to less rebound. It's always, I'll give it one more click. So don't be afraid to turn your knobs the opposite way. Turn your damping and your rebound way further, lighter than you think it should be, and try that and see how it works. Don't always add. Sometimes you can subtract damping and see where that takes you.
Okay. So letting the fork rebound faster.
Yes. Set it faster than you think you should and see where that takes you. You'll probably find that you've been adding damping every time you make an adjustment and you've never backed it off. So back it off once in a while.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. I've kind of gone that direction fairly recently and found it pretty good. In fact, I'm almost running it as fast as I feel I can before it gets a bit too lively. But yeah, it does seem to track better. So. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, I think that Jason covered it pretty well. And it's really, if you don't have a balance of a bike, which means the spring setup or the air pressure setup right, then there's no point in actually touching the hydraulic at all. So you need always to start with a balance of a bike where you are, and then you can start working with the clickers. It is a difference depending what type of track you are on. If it's very dry or if it's wet, you can change your suspension to a little bit in, depending on what you want to achieve. So that's where you can use the clickers from where you have a basic setup. But the fundamentals is important to the suspension from the beginning are set up, so it should work pretty well with any type of rider on that bike. So if you keep to where you should be and what your recommendations are, then you move in the areas where you want to go depending on track, depending on day, on wet conditions or tire or whatever it could be.
Yeah, cool. And any top tips on looking after suspension? I've felt quite a few people's bikes that look like it could do with some love, but any top tips for just keeping your suspension healthy between servicing?
Especially for the fork, it is important that you don't that you're careful when you're washing the bike, that you don't shooting in dirt through the seals. You can very easily destroy the whole function and the whole damping if you have too much dirt coming through your fork seals. So basically, the fork will get useless pretty soon. So the clicker doesn't matter anymore. So paying attention to mud, paying attention to how you clean your bike. These are good tips. The shocks normally are not so sensitive for that. If you have an air shock, yes, but normally they're not that sensitive in the same way as a fork.
All right. Good stuff. Good advice. Thank you very much, guys. Been super interesting chatting with you both today. If people want to find out a bit more about either of your respective companies, where can they find you on the internet? Jason, start with you.
Well, we're at specialized.com, obviously, and there's a full range of on-road, off-road equipment there. If you dig into the mountain bike side, there's lots of tech tips buried on the site that can help to get you started.
All right, good stuff. Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes for this episode so people can find that. What about you, Torkel?
It's the same thing. We have Orleans.com, and basically you will find a lot of information about your suspension there. It's the same thing here. We have a lot about car suspension, motorbike suspension, and also mountain bike suspension. So we are a pretty wide company when it comes to suspension in general.
Great stuff. All right. Well, thanks a lot for your time today, guys, and really looking forward to seeing how the 2019 season goes down for your athletes.
It's going to be exciting.
Yeah, good stuff. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. A massive thanks again to 661 for supporting the episode. And don't forget, as a Downtime listener, you can get 25% off the whole 661 range by heading to 661.com and using the code DOWNTIMEPODCAST25. That link and the code are going to be in the show notes for this episode over on DOWNTIMEPODCAST.com, where you find everything you need podcast related and a link to our web store if you want to grab some of our top quality merch. Right, we'll have another episode for you really soon, but until next time, get out and ride.